Mr. Black Reel 2. So you took on more responsibility, and presumably that meant that your wage went up. Was it an annual increase on your wage as your birthday came along?
That was the anomaly. The apprentices, yes, it worked for them that way. Automatically, they got a rise on their birthday. And I used to get a card presented to me through the window from so-and-so, rise due, to make sure that they got their rise. In my case, I always had to go and ask for it. And it was quite hard work, actually, getting it. It was... I don't know, it was a sort of system divide and conquer, and the officers, I mean, nobody was on a sort of level wage. Somebody would be on such and such a thing, and then he would go and ask for a rise, and he would get 1 and 6 pence, or half a crown, or something like that. Then somebody else would go and ask, and he would get a bob, and there was nothing sort of standard about it. I got to the stage, I mean, after a while, it took me quite a while, because I wasn't very forward in those days. But I thought, well, if I don't ask, I'm not going to get. So every time my birthday did come round, I went up and asked. And invariably, I got a reasonable rise. But, and I mean, it wasn't a lot. Even when I left to go to the army, I think I was only at about 18 and sixpence a week. That was after, I don't know...
And your money would obviously help the household situation.
Oh, yes, yes. It was a bit, because, well, I mean, just before I left, went into the army, my father died at 45, so my mother was left, so it was the breadwinner's money, actually.
And you handed it all over?
Oh, yes.
And
I
get your pocket money?
Got the pocket money, yes. It was all handed over. And just
now, how much pocket money do you recall?
Well... When I first got my 7 and 6 pence, I used to get the overtime, which was 1 and 6 pence a week.
And it would go a long way, though, 1 and 6.
It went a fair way. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, it met my needs at the time, shall we say that, which they weren't great. I mean.
We're now in the mid to late 1930s, aren't we, of your life?
Yes.
Do you recall the problems that were beginning to form on the continent? Did you know what was happening there?
Oh, yes, yes. I took a keen interest. I mean, we had sessions at school on current affairs and this sort of thing, and they kept us fairly well up to date with, what was happening. I mean, we knew there were sort of rumblings going on, and then, of course, in the 38s, as you know, the Munich crisis hit us. And
were people nervous about oncoming war? They had the experience of the First World War.
I kind of say there was no jitters. I don't think anybody thought it was jittery. What did happen, I mean, in the place where I worked, that's how I come to join the territories. The chaps would say, right, if there's going to be a war coming on, I'm going to make sure I'm in the unit that I want to be in. So we join the territorials, and there was three from the office, which was the time office and the general office, joined the territorials the same time as me. And quite a few of the workmen in the yard joined the territorials at the same time.
The bosses encouraged the men to join the territorials, did they?
Oh, yeah, yes.
And
yes.
This was the reason why you joined? You felt that you wanted to get into a unit that you...
Well, I felt I wanted to get in a unit of my choice. I didn't want to be just pushed anywhere.
So what was the date in which you joined the territorials?
It was 1938, just as the Munich crisis was coming on. Actually, where the regiment was sent off on special service at the time of the Munich crisis. They were literally at battle stations in this country, and I joined just as the crisis developed. I didn't get a chance to to go to be called up for that, because we hadn't been issued with our uniforms then. But we were issued, so it was early 1938 when I joined the Territorials.
And what was the process of joining?
We just went up to Northfield Gardens and said we wanted to join. And
was that a drill hall?
The drill hall, yes. Yes. Sign the dotted line and take the king's shilling.
Can you describe the drill hall as a building?
Yes, it was an absolutely up-to-date, modern building, big building. Had every facilities for drill. Plenty of space outside for the vehicles and the searchlights. A decent other ranks mess, a good sergeant's mess and an officer's mess. As I say, very much up to date, and it's, of course, it's still in existence, Northfield Gardens, and in spite of the fact that a more modern drill hall just next door to it was built in the 1960s, has now been demolished, but Northfield Gardens is still there.
What was your reception like? I mean, outside of the actual process of joining, what was the reception that you got from the officers and men when you first joined? Those that were already there, of course, those that were in the unit.
Well, very, very, very friendly, really. I mean, they didn't want to sort of stand in your way. I mean, they weren't sort of, come in, this sort of thing. I mean, you are accepted, and this is it. I mean, no harassment or anything like that.
And you were 18
then? I was 18 then, yes.
What was the name of the unit itself?
The unit was 389 Battery of the 47th Searchlight Regiment.
And that originally had been...
It had been the seventh DLIs, and it was changed, I think, in they were invited by the War Office in 1936 to change to searchlights from the DLI, to change to engineers.
Did you know why they changed from infantry to searchlights?
I think they probably felt that there was going to be a need for searchlights. I mean, there was a big thing made about searchlights and picking up the planes and what have you, but of course they were superseded, weren't they, very early in the war.
The first drills that you did, presumably, the training, what were the first elements of the training? After just joining?
Well, we're more or less straight away. You had your formal drill, you know, the fall in and this sort of thing. And when you went on the first drill night, you fell in. You were told off in sections and then in detachments. And then you're falling out in your detachments and... You had an instructor in each detachment who took you through the various drills on the searchlights and on the sound locators that went with the searchlights.
So that you were having basic infantry drill, I suppose, in a sense.
Well, it was, and not a lot actually of sort of infantry drill. I mean, it was it was drilled to get your marching, let's put it that way.
And at the same time, they took you immediately onto
the technicalities. I think they were very, very keen to get us to get us going. I mean,
when did you get your uniforms?
I think I had it. We had it, the uniform about 3 weeks after joining.
What did they issue you with?
Well, they issued with the old... it was the tunic with the brass buttons, the peak cap, putties, the old putties.
First World War?
Well, more or less, yes. Uh-huh.
And shirts and underwear, that kind of thing?
Shirt, yes, but not underwear.
And was it just the one uniform, or did you get two?
No, we had one, just one at the time. Mm-hmm.
Army boots?
Army boots. 13 studs to the boot.
How did you take the army boots? Because in a clerical job, you hadn't worn heavy boots, had you?
No, I took them pretty well straight away. I mean, I had no sort of bother with them.
And you would have to keep this clean, of course.
Oh yes, you had to be blankoed up and the boots polished and for every drill you went. I mean, we went to two drill nights a week and a weekend camp about every month. So,
which drill nights were they?
Well, I went on Tuesdays and Thursdays actually.
And you took a uniform home with you, obviously.
Oh yes, yes, you kept your uniform at home, yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you do it all yourself? Did your mother do any of it?
No, I did. I did it all.
Weekend camp, you said, every month. Once a month.
Once a month. Sometimes once. I mean, you're under no obligation to do the weekend camp. I mean, that was if you did, you got the army basic rate to pay for going. But I mean, I think they had to do it like that because, I mean, not everyone could sort of get away for a full weekend.
And was there a payment for your drill nights? Did you get?
Oh, yes.
How much was that at that time?
It was the basic army rate, which was two bob a day. And you got, at the end of each year, you got a bounty of £5.
On the camps, the weekend camps, what were you doing there for two nights, three nights, or whatever number?
Well,
the
camps were fairly local. I mean, the drill halls, Northfield Gardens, and they used to send you out to sites just, well, probably half a mile away. As a detachment, you had your lorry with your searchlight and your sound locator and your Lewis gun. Belt tent, cooking shelter, and the necessary cooking gear, and they plunk into the field, and then you sort of set up your camp. And of course, principally, naturally, most of our work was done at night time with a searchlight. We used to get cooperation from the Air Force. They put a target across, and we had to pick them up on the sound locators and put the lights on them.
So it was an extension to what you were training.
Yes.
Can we have a look at the searchlights now, at that time, 1938, 39? Can you describe the searchlight for me?
Well, the first one that we had was what they called the 90 centimetre searchlight. It was metric then. Well, literally, it was a big arc light. Just the carbon arc inside. We used to have a lister for to supply the power. It used to, when you call what they call struck arc, there was an actual arc burning inside the projector, an electric arc.
It arced between
the positive and negative, and it was a very, very powerful light. And of course that was reflected on the convex mirror at the rear, very, very accurately polished mirror. In fact, how we used to line them up for to make sure the arc was correct was to line them up on the sun and actually get the sun reflecting from the back of the mirror onto the arc itself. And if that was right, your arc was absolutely correct for your light.
And how big was it? I mean, maybe difficult for you to say, but how large was this instrument, this searchlight instrument?
Well, as I say, it was called the 90 centimetre.
And how was it manoeuvred?
It was, you had what they called a long arm. There was a sort of arm on the searchlight itself, approximately about 12 foot long, and a wheel on the end, and the number four, as he was, he was on the wheel. It sort of directed the searchlight. Horizontal was governed by the fact that he pushed it round on its base, and the the vertical was with this wheel that lifted anywhere. And of course he was under direction from the spotters, who used to sit about 50 yards either side of the searchlight and listen through the sound locators, which were like four big trumpets. They're just square trumpets, and you had to use what they call the binaural sense. And it's a fact that if you if you had a buzzer sort of crossing the room, eventually it sort of passes from one ear to the other, and eventually you can get it in the centre of your forehead. And that was when you were on target, and they'd shout on target, and they'd give directions in the old days to the chap on the long arm, and they were very, very basic, you know, right, up, right a bit, right, stop, left, and so on like that, with verbal instructions. And then on the extremes, again, you had a couple of spotters. They were reclining WD deck chairs, as it were, lying on their backs with binoculars. And they were watching. And, of course, as soon as they saw the target, if the beam was getting in the right direction, they would then take over, because they had them in the beam. It sounds easy, but really it was a bit with that sort of equipment, it was a bit difficult. It was different when sort of forerunner of radar came on, and it was
pretty basic, wasn't it?
Oh, it was very, very, very primitive. Basic. It was. Well, it was literally just back from the First World War. I mean, they had the same ones in the First World War.
I mean, you would have thought that, you know, if you had been in an action situation with all the noise, how did people hear the orders that were being shouted in the directions?
Well,
although I think you'd be well away from guns, were you?
Oh, yeah, we're well away. I mean, the searchlights were always well away from guns. I mean, the only thing that we had in the way of a gun was a Lewis gun.
What was that purpose? To defend
the site? To defend the site, yes.
Uh-huh. What could you tell me about the other crew members and their responsibilities?
Yeah, well, it started off with the NCO in charge of the site. He was generally a corporal. I'm talking about engineers now, not army, not artillery. He was in charge of the site. Number two and number three were spotters. Four was the long arm man. Number five was the what they call the searchlight operator, and he, when they shouted on target or anything like that, the number one, the NCO in charge, would shout expose beam, and he would throw the switch to put the beam on. Seven and eight were on the sound locators. One was on the vertical, and one's on the horizontal trumpets. Nine was the Lister man. He was in charge of the Lister generating set.
And where was that in relation to this?
Oh, the Lister was always at least 200 to 300 yards away, again because of the noise, and sheltered if possible. It had to be sheltered, really. We had the Lister, but also the Guy lorries were adapted so that, as well as being a lorry, they became a generator to supply the power to the searchlight.
Now, how did it work, the Lister? Can you tell me?
It was just a diesel engine very large diesel engine. Took an awful lot of start, especially in the winter. You had to swing it.
And one man had this task.
Yes. He looked after the Lister. And the sorry.
I was going to ask for number six. I think we missed number six out, did we?
No, number. Did we? Yes, I. Number six was the. He was the the chap in charge of the sound recorder, and he was generally a lance corporal in the, and again in the engineers, and he was responsible for the aim off, because obviously when you hear the sound from a plane, you're not looking in the correct direction. I mean, the plane has passed that point by then. So he operated a Heath Robinson sight, like a clock sight, which he estimated aim off, and he had to estimate the speed of the plane. Well, that's as you say, Heath Robinson. But sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't.
The Lewis gun, then, did it have its own gunner?
No, the Lewis gun was it was manned by number 7 and number 8 of the sound locator. If they had to, if you had to defend the site, they had to nip away and get to the Lewis gun and fire it.
How long would it take a trained crew to get, say, from beds or wherever they were relaxing onto the site and get the searchlight operating? What kind of time factor?
Oh, minutes. I mean, when we first called up, we were more or less on permanent standby. In fact, for the first 2 months when we were called up, although it was the phony war, I never had my clothes off, except for once a week we used to go down to Darlington to have a bath. But I mean, you were fully dressed the whole, even lying down in bed. You'd,
so you get straight out, obviously.
You jumped straight out, yes.
Can we just go back? Do you remember what you were doing the day that Chamberlain made the announcement, the Sunday morning?
Yes, I was on a farm in Aldwark in Yorkshire.
So you'd been called up. You'd been called up by then.
Oh yeah, we were called up on the 24th of August. That was long before the rest were called up round about when war was declared. The likes of the field artillery, etc. But I mean, we were called up the 24th of August, and we're already on these sites in Teesside.
Yeah. Before we come to that, I should have probably brought this in a bit earlier. Can you describe the constitution of the regiment, in the sense of how many companies, etc.?
Yeah, well, when we first started, it was, as I say, the 47th Searchlight Regiment, RE, Royal Engineers. And, of course, the regimental headquarters, which was at Dykelands Road in Sunderland, there was 386 Battery, which is in Sunderland, 387, which was in Sunderland, 388, which is in Sunderland, 389, of course, which was raised in South Shields. And each of those batteries were divided into four troops, or four sections, as there were in the engineers. Were troops when we became artillery. 389 was 13 section, 14 section, 15 section, and 16 section. And each of those sections had six searchlights.
They were quite large sections.
Oh yes. Well, you're talking about 10 men on a site, so you had 60. You had 60 men in a section plus. Headquarters section staff, mechanics and things like that at the headquarters. You had about 70, 80 men in each section. I mean, actually, the regiment in those days were quite big. I mean, literally, you had over nearly 400 men in each company. So you're talking about over 1,600 men in the regiment. And we were up to full strength.
Who was commanding?
When we first went, it was Lieutenant Colonel Squance.
And what was he like?
He was quite a gentleman. He was a solicitor in Sunderland, and I can't say any sort of thing wrong about them. I mean, this is the point that with I don't know whether I've been lucky or not, but we had a good selection of officers in the territorials. I mean, there was the occasional one, but in the main, he was quite good. His sort of second in command was Major Johnson.
Do you know his background?
He was a solicitor as well. And the command of the officer commanding Shields was Major Wood. They were all sort of business people.
So you had Major Wood on your section commander.
Well, as the battery commander.
Sorry, battery commander 389, and that was split up into sections, as you've
already. Yes, four sections.
What rank would command a section?
Well, the sections were commanded either by a lieutenant, a full lieutenant, or a captain.
And beneath him, you know, what was the hierarchy of command beneath him in each section?
Well, you had the section commander, then you had his second in command. You generally had two officers on each section, occasionally three if someone if another one sort of joined for training, anything like that. Then you had a troop sergeant on each section, and some of the detachments had a sergeant or a lance sergeant, but principally it was a corporal.
To come back to your particular section, who were the commanding officers and the NCOs in your particular section at the beginning?
At the beginning was Lieutenant Johnson. He was a local man, worked for the Building Society. I think actually he's still around. I'm not very sure, but he had a serious illness towards the about 10, 15 years ago, and I haven't heard anything of him since. I think he left the district. A Lieutenant Little, who's a very, very nice man, a real gentleman. I always remember him because when he joined us at the in the Territorials drill night, he came to me and I hadn't been in very long. He says, "I wonder if you could do me a favour. I would love a bar of chocolate. Can you get me one out of the other ranks, miss?" I don't know whether they didn't have any upstairs.